Hi, my name's Ali, and this is the Rus Files Unite podcast, where we watch Russian films and films with a Russian connection. As always, I am joined by a guest, and this time around, once again, joined by...
Lynn, hello. I'm back. The time between the last episode I recorded with you and the one before that was about a year? 9 months, maybe.
Yeah.
And now it's been a week.
Yes, so it's very irregular. Also, you're back and wearing black, so that's...
Yes, I'm back and wearing black, despite it being nominally summer.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're also in a black car.
Yeah.
It's a slightly different version than the last time we recorded the car when we went to see Lady Macbeth.
Yes, yeah, it's a long time already. It's... Over 2 years.
Oh my goodness, it is over 2 years. Was it February or something? I remember it being a lot colder than it is today.
Yes, I think it was Feb or March. It was pretty soon after we recorded the pilot.
We're at the other side of the same car park. There is more people because it is earlier in the day.
Yeah, so we apologize for any weird background sound.
Yeah, people and cars, what are they doing?
Yeah, yeah. But I'm figuring if you're a regular listener, you're probably not listening for the... stunning audio quality. Here for the content.
Yes, here for the sweet content.
Yes, which we will deliver now.
Yes, why are we here? We're going to see a film, the same reason that we were also here last time.
Yeah, because that is the...
Rather than just, you know, recording in the car for the sake of being kicked out of the house.
Exactly, yeah, the nominal aim of the podcast. So, what are we watching today? Lynn?
Is it Anna? Or Anna? How do you pronounce it? I don't know.
Probably more of an Anna with an R rather than A.
I don't know much about this movie except it looks bad and it's directed by Luc Besson, who is a guy that I generally like the movies of, even though it turns out, like most people in the industry that are middle-aged white men, he might be slightly problematic.
Oh, has he done stuff?
I don't think on a sort of like Harvey Weinstein level.
Right.
But yeah. Anyway, I don't know how he had money to make this film, because didn't Valerian like bankrupt him and his entire company?
I didn't know that level of detail. I know it did not do very well. I did see it. And
I quite liked it.
It was, I mean, this is the thing. I've not seen all of his films by any means, but I've seen quite a few. And it's fair to say that the adjective baroque might be applied to them, which I like to think that I don't enjoy that. But if I'm honest, I kind of admire the throw everything at the screen approach. So I thought Valerian was tosh, but like with fish element.
The fish element.
The fish element. Yeah. It was a sequel to A Fish Called Wanda.
I was going for sort of like Finding Nemo thing, but yeah. I couldn't get there in time.
Yeah, so there was A Fish Called Wanda, then there was The Fish Element, and then there was
Valerian in the City of a Fout. This is really not working. Anyway.
You're floundering, Lynn.
I am floundering. Is
floundering.
Anna...
Hey! Floundering.
Is Anna based on something? Because Valerian's based on a series of comic strips.
Yeah, as far as I know, no. I have to get this quibble out of the way because I'm a relentless pedant
right.
in certain things. So, with the posters for this, they have a very nice symmetrical, because it's the name of the film is just Anna.
Mm-hmm.
They have A-N, backwards N, A, because everyone knows backwards N is a Russian letter.
It's true. I knew that.
The problem is what looks like a backwards N, so that it mirrors with normal, you know, normal.
Latin,
yes. Thank you, Lynn, for... yes, like... Because everyone knows Latin is the default alphabet and all other alphabets are just weird variants that are somehow less legitimate. Ugh. I am not that terrible person.
Having said that, mirrors the Latin N.
It mirrors the Latin N, but the Russian sound that it makes is a long E, so it's E. So this film, if you're, like I say, a ferocious pedant, it should be Ania or Ania?
I'm kind of hoping that they have run with this and we'll get in there and everyone pronounces her name Anya.
Yeah, which is not really a Russian normal name. But there's, this is a slight bugbear. And in fact, I'm not the only person who feels like this, because there is a Twitter account that, I forget the exact handle, but the slogan is "No Faux Cyrillic," because obviously anything that's mildly Russian themed will press various Cyrillic letters into service as what as the thing they most resemble in the Latin alphabet, and frequently that is not what they actually sound like. So I thought I'd get that out of the way.
I've just noticed as a child walking in front of this car that is wearing a Russian-esque fur hat, which is appropriate, even though it's way too hot for any kind of hat.
Yeah, I feel like this is a style choice, even though he's way too young to, you'd think, to be making that sort of statement. But yeah. I don't know at what point
I'm just looking at coincidences that tie into this podcast.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of hat is a Shapka Ushanka.
Nice. I'm not going to try and pronounce that.
Oh, go on.
Shapka?
Shapka.
Shapka.
Ushanka.
Shapka Ushanka. Is he a sit-up player? Sorry for clipping there.
It took me a split second to go, oh yeah, I get that joke now. Of course, if I have botched the pronunciation of Shapka Ushanka, or I'm saying it wrong, then it's all going to go in the audio trash. So
all in the trash.
But yeah, yeah. Shapka is like a general like word for hat. But
okay.
Yeah, I don't know what Ushanka is. Russian listeners, write in. What's the derivation? Give us the etymology right now.
I don't know. So I have seen, I don't think I've seen the trailer for this film. I've seen a couple of screenshots.
Okay.
It looked like it's going to be a sort of like faux Cold War thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the setting. I have seen the trailer a few times and it's like kicky, fighty. So this is the genre of espionage film that's espionage / action, as opposed to espionage, we're creeping around buildings and there might be an action scene, but it's not the main point. You know, this isn't like Bridge of Spies or whatever.
Okay. I rewatched Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy the other day.
Yeah, this is not that.
Not that, okay. No. good film though. I was just trying to think of Luke Besson connection because the main guy in it was in The Fifth Element.
Yeah.
It's very tenuous, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to remember. I haven't seen that since the cinema, actually, which is, it's getting on for quite a few years ago.
2011, I think.
Yeah, that was the time where Gary Oldman was like,
that's the Badger,
thought to be on for winning the Oscar and then didn't quite. Am I getting this right?
I think so. He's played some strange roles.
Of course. Yeah, I was forgetting he was in Fifth Element because he just does not look like him. He is not in this one, sadly.
Oh, that's disappointing. Maybe he'll make a cameo.
There are a couple of famous people in this.
You haven't even read the cast list. I'm so ill-prepared for this.
How dare you?
Or by not...
Not knowing anything. Not knowing just being dropped in and having to, you know, think on your feet and work your way through it and survive to the end of the mission. And
trailers,
maybe,
spoilers.
Maybe kill some people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have... Like I say, I've seen the trailer and it looks very action-y. I feel similarly unprepared in that I haven't seen any of the John Wick movies. I know. Take my film podcast away from me right now. And I also haven't seen Atomic Blonde, and I think Atomic Blonde is probably
I haven't seen Atomic Blonde either. Is that Charlize Theron?
It is.
Okay.
And lots of, like, 80s synth rock.
I have not seen John Wick 3, despite it coming out, like, 2 months ago. Mm. But I've seen the first two.
Yeah, I need to see them. And, they're Russo Files Unite fodder, you know. There's Russian gangsters, and they say Baba Yaga a bunch of times.
They do. That's
and I think they
true.
Actually say it Baba Yaga, which is the correct pronunciation, rather than Baba
it's
Yaga.
So realistic and accurate, the John Wick franchise. So, I mean, why would they not?
Yeah.
Is Keanu going to be in this film?
Sadly not.
Oh.
But in terms of famous people who are in it, bringing it back around, we have Helen Mirren.
Nice.
And we also have Cillian Murphy.
Okay.
So they wanted to be in it.
Yeah. I've yet to see a film where Cillian Murphy isn't playing someone slightly creepy.
I have a feeling he may be slightly creepy in this.
That's
one.
Okay.
Yeah. I've never seen him like warm and friendly and lovely.
No, but maybe he will be. I'm sure he's not creepy in real life. Sorry, Kelly Murphy, if you're listening.
some news will break between now and the release of the episode, and we'll have to be like,
we'll have to edit this out.
Yeah, and like record in a completely different audio environment. We totally condemn Cillian Murphy for being a terrible person who shouldn't be in movies anymore.
Yes.
That killed things.
Yeah.
I also, again, as we seem to do this when you're the guest, I confess to not having seen movies.
Yep.
I haven't seen Leon, which is...
Neither have I.
Oh, no. Which is like the... I don't know whether that's the definitive Luc Besson film.
The Fifth Element is the definitive Luc Besson film.
Yeah, but I think Leon is probably like the one that people will say is actually good.
What?
But...
I love Fifth Element.
It's a while since I've seen it, but yeah. I mean, in a world where big budget movies are either reboots or continuations or part of, you know, some extended universe, the fact that it's a standalone story with its own world and whatnot, that's something I liked about Fifth Element, which is obviously from a lot longer ago, and going back to Valerian, I liked the fact that that was, okay, yes, it was an adaptation of another media, but it wasn't just like, oh, we're going to take some characters who the whole audience is familiar with. So I kind of admire that for going in that direction.
I thought the cast was a bit too young in Valerian.
Hmm.
Not this is a Valerian podcast, but having read the comics, I just feel like the two main characters, okay. Especially Valerian himself, like everyone seemed like they were sort of teenagers. But
Gotcha.
Yeah, it was fun. Anyway, what are we talking about?
Would you recommend... Yes.
Would you recommend Valerian?
Yes, and the comic book?
Yeah, definitely recommend the comic book. It's weird.
I've heard that. I've heard that the, I've forgotten a character's name, but the main, besides Valerian, the main female character.
Lorelei.
That shouldn't be a forgettable name, because I'm a big Gilmore Girls fan.
Okay, never seen Gilmore Girls.
The first few seasons are worth checking out.
Cool.
It does go very silly towards the end. I mean, it's silly all the way through, but it's like enjoyable silly to begin with, and then it kind of runs out of steam a bit.
Although they did take her name out of the because the comics are Valerian and Lorelei.
Oh, okay. And they renamed her for the film?
Yes, and for the reissues of the English translations of the comics after the film was announced.
Interesting. Is this for like owning all the correct copyright type reasons?
I don't know. I just seemed to me like maybe it was sexism or something. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Who knows? Huh. It just seemed a bit weird. But
yeah.
Anyway, yes. I don't know much about the history of comics, but the evolution of like American style comics and French style comics are like apparently quite distinct.
Mm. Okay, and not necessarily. Well, I was going to say something really snobby there. I was going to say, like, well, clearly American comics would never influence my French one. Well, what I mean by that is there's probably more French arty people who read English than American arty people who read French.
That seems likely.
It seems true, but yes.
Apologies to those French Canadian comic writers, but
yes. So Valerian. That was Valerian cast.
It's good.
Should do a Valerian minute by minute.
Of the film or of the comics. We just do like a panel an episode. It's very slow.
That would be even more niche audience than this thing, which was, is an achievement.
It was weird watching the film and then being like, oh, it's a bit like Star Wars, when apparently George Lucas adapted a lot of stuff from the Valerian comics for Star Wars.
I remember hearing that he was a fan, yeah.
Yeah, if you read the first like couple of ones, there's quite a lot of designs and stuff that are quite similar. I mean, cross-pollination is fine. I'm not like having no George Lucas.
Well,
that's what happens. It's art. People borrow stuff.
Yeah, as the quote that I made up, and definitely wasn't Oscar Wilde, talent borrows, genius steals.
Exactly.
That's an original thought by me. Yeah. Definitely not that 19th century Anglo-Irish guy.
No. His gravestone memorial thing's weird in London, isn't it?
I think
I walked past it. I was like,
I've never seen it. I didn't know he was buried in London.
I think he is, but I think there's a memorial is what I'm thinking of. Someone in the center
of
London. Anyway. Oscar Wilde, ladies and gentlemen.
He was a person.
He was a person. I feel really bad, so I've never read the whole of an Oscar Wilde thing. I've read bits of A Picture of Dorian Gray and a little bit of The Battle of Red and Jail, but I've never, like, read the whole of Oscar Wilde thing.
I've read Dorian Gray cover to cover, but it was a long, long, long time ago. Tell you what, the movie of Dorian Gray was just not good.
No?
Yeah. That was when I was going to the cinema all the time and just watching. I mean, it could have been good. Anyway, I feel like we are straying.
We've just run out of things to say about Anya.
Yes. Anya.
Oh, sorry. Anya.
Yeah. Well, you see, the Russian poster doesn't have that problem because the Russian N, which looks like an H, a capital H, is obviously symmetrical. So inherently symmetrical.
So more symmetry in letters.
Yes.
That's what we want. Yeah. More H's and capital A's. Yeah.
Because
also capital H's.
My research did include looking up the film on the Russian film site Kino Poisk, which means film search. So the other Russian connection with this film that we're watching is that the main actor, actress, lead is Sasha Luce, and she is actually Russian.
Yeah. So,
and she was in Valerian as one of like the beautiful, ethereal, alien-y creatures with the pearls at the beginning, but obviously she was in so much makeup / CGI that there's no way you would recognize her other than, you know, very skinny.
Fair enough.
So, yes.
I think we're out of things to say about a film we haven't seen yet, so we should go and see the film.
I think we are. We should go and see the film. But what do we say at this point in the podcast?
Paekeli!
Almost. It's more like a ch.
Oh.
Yekeli.
Paekeli.
That's good. Yeah.
Is that okay? I was going too Dutch on the...
Yeah, the Dutch, like Dutch / Welsh or something.
Dutch / Welsh. That's where my accent has settled.
I mean, I know you've lived in Holland. I don't know.
True.
The Netherlands, because I know Holland is...
Well, I mean, I did live in Holland, but yes.
Right. Yes, I am not doing the rookie thing of using Holland for the whole of the Netherlands, because I know that's strictly speaking not correct.
Yep. Anyway. BBC says it's okay for the football team, I discovered the other day.
Oh, okay.
But only if you're talking about the football team.
Gotcha. But isn't one of their chants is something like... Oh,
Hup Holland Hup. Sorry, that was slightly anglicised pronunciation there, but yes.
Better than, what I was going to go for. So, in that context, apparently it's allowed. We are learning so much.
On this
episode. But yeah, so, 3, 2, 1.
Paekeli!
Paekeli!
Lynn and I have just watched the film Anna. I'm getting the pronunciation a bit closer to the authentic Russian this time, I think. So before we tell you what we thought of the film, we're just going to have a quick summary from Lynn. So if you haven't watched it yet, then this is when we'll have spoilers. And if that's something that bothers you, yes, pause the podcast, watch the film, and then you can proceed unspoiled. So with that out the way,
There may be fewer spoilers than anticipated, because it was a little bit incoherent and I'm not sure I knew exactly what was going on. But we'll give it a go.
Over to you.
So is it 1990 or 1985, because my timeline is confused. Anyway, I think it might be 1990. They're in Moscow, and then a lot of American agents get chased down by the KGB, and they all end up getting heads chopped off and sent to the CIA.
To be fair, we only see one decapitated head in the box, but it does...
That's true.
Yeah, it does start out quite, like, ideas-wise graphic, because you just see the face through some, like, plastic. It's not, like, a gory, like, dripping head, but it's just, like, a face staring out of a box, which, you know, doesn't have room for the rest of a person. So it's more like... That's a horrible idea, rather than you see huge amounts of gore. But anyway.
Exactly. And it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of setting up with a level of, like, continued drama. And do they ever even come back to the head bits, or I'm getting ahead of myself? That was not an intentional pun. I apologize.
It was so unintentional.
It was so unintentional, just passed you by.
Went over my head.
Wait.
Okay, well, continue with the summary. Chop, chop.
Then what happens? Wait, I'm trying to remember the order of exactly what happens. But then there is a French fashion guy in a market.
Yes.
In a market in Moscow. And there is beautiful... What are those dolls? Mastroika? Is that not the word? That's probably not the word.
It's close. It's Matryoshka. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sorry, slightly patronizing.
No. I need it. I need to be patronized in Russian. So anyway, she is selling these in this market.
Ostensibly.
Yes, as we will discover later. We never see her actually sell any. But this French fashion model scout comes up to her and is like, oh, you're beautiful. That wasn't even French. That was just a terrible accent.
generic foreign.
Generic. Oh, God. It's the worst Britishness. Foreigners, they all sound the same, do they? So don't put this bit on the internet. So anyway, so she ends up in Paris, having taken up this scout's offer, and she moves in, and it is, as you would imagine, not quite the amazing experience that the scout promised. She's in a shared flat, everyone is everywhere and sleeping on the floor, and in her bedroom, and it's just a bit of a mess. Anyway, skip forward 3 months. 3 months? She is at a fancy swankidoo, and there's an older... a sort of middle-aged man who comes up to her and they start flirting and then they decide to go off dinner and then we move forward a bit more into the future. I'm going to say another 3 months. I can't remember whether it was, but sure, that makes sense.
I think that's about right, actually.
Yeah, and she's talking to him and she's like, oh, I don't really know anything about you. What do you do? And he's like, oh, I smuggle arms. And she's like, oh, I'm just going to the bathroom, as you do. And then comes out and then shoots him. And it turns out that she was a spy.
Dun dun dun.
Flashback.
There's no way that you would have guessed this from the trailer or the, you know, promotional pictures.
No. Yeah. There was no way of knowing. It was a crazy plot twist that no one could see coming. Anyway, flashback to like 5 years and she is, well, looking the same age, I guess, because they filmed at the same time. But she's meant to be 5 years younger. It's 1985. And she's living in a crummy flat in Moscow. With an abusive boyfriend, and they go out and try and rob an ATM. Apparently, it's the first ATM in Russia, supposedly. Then they get chased by the police. She goes back to the flat, and there's a mysterious guy there that's like, come and work for the KGB. And she's like, well, if I don't want to. He's like, well, I guess we'll kill you then.
Well, she says something like, either I accept your offer or you're going to murder me, right? And he's like, yep, pretty much. I knew you were a smart one. And she's like, right.
Yeah, so then she slits her wrist. And it's very... It's kind of shocking, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty graphic.
There aren't many things in this film that are particularly shocking, even when it kind of wants you to be more shocked. But yeah, that bit is actually quite shocking and graphic. And the camera lingers on a lot of blood. While she talks to this guy. Anyway, he's like, oh, don't waste your life here. You could do great things for your country or whatever. We need people like you. So she is eventually persuaded. So then she gets trained by the KGB and her boss, Helen Mirren, who took me quite a long time to realise it was Helen Mirren, but it was Helen Mirren, is very sceptical of her. And then this continues in the manner you might expect until we get to the point where we see them plant her as the Russian doll seller in this market so she can be picked up by the fashion agency guy who is not in on this. He has just been manipulated into finding her. And it turns out, you know, he was planted there, she was planted there, and then so she'd go back to Paris and kill this arms dealer. So thus we have a backstory. There's an undercurrent in all of this that she would like to get out of the KGB, that she saw this as a kind of temporary thing.
She was specifically promised, you
she
know.
She was, yes.
Was it 5 years?
I think 5 years,
us,
yeah.
And then you're free to go and we'll give you lots of money and you'll just have a nice rest of your life.
But it turns out there is only one way out of the KGB, and that is heavily implied that death is the only way out of the KGB. Does anyone ever explicitly say it? I don't know.
I mean, the head of the KGB does point a pistol, like, right at her forehead.
Oh, yeah, good point.
And
that's
she's like,
how much has
okay,
you
okay, point taken. We're not in the business of, of subtle messages here.
No. So
as we discovered from the heads in boxes earlier, or the one head and the implied other heads.
Yeah, it's not a superly, super subtle spy film. So she... Ooh, yeah, I'm getting this next bit in slightly the wrong order, because you see her undertake a mission, and then there's a flashback that explains it, but I'm just going to explain the whole thing in roughly chronological order. So she has to go and do a mission in a hotel, which has to pretend to be a prostitute or an escort or whatever, and then kill another sleazy arms dealer guy, I guess. But it turns out that the CIA know she's a spy and know that this is going down, and then they're in the room with the seedy guy and catch her and say, look, you should come work for us. It will be much better than working for the KGB, and we need you to take out the head of the KGB because he's a jerk. I'm paraphrasing. He is a jerk. We've seen him in some other scenes. But the CIA are like, yeah, you know, we used to get along okay before this guy got promoted, but now
and
it's
then
all
started
bad.
Cutting people's heads off and sending sending them to us.
Exactly. So then it turns out that she takes the CIA up on this offer, and it also turns out that the current deputy head of the KGB, Helen Mirren, also doesn't like the head of the KGB, and she's kind of okay with this. So the climax, or almost climax, of the film is Anna going into the head of the CIA's, sorry, the head of the KGB's office, playing chess with him, and then winning, and then shooting him, and then trying to get out of the building, while she gets chased by all these other Russian soldiers that are all guarding the building. But it turns out there's no easy way to get out of the CIA either. And then I've kind of forgotten what happens. What happens then? What happens at the end of this film?
Oh, she goes back to Paris.
Yes.
And she's supposed to be meeting up with her CIA
handler
in the park. Of course, the KGB are not best pleased with the fact that she's put a bullet in the head of their, you know, now a former head of the KGB. And so there's kind of a standoff in the park.
That's right.
She walks off. I can't remember what she walks off with. I've forgotten the name of the main CIA dude. But anyway, she goes away, and then Olga, her immediate line manager, puts several bullets in her, and we assume that's, you know, good night for her.
But it turns out that it isn't.
Dun dun dun.
It turns out that she can go and have a nice kind of life. Sort of.
Yes.
So it works out all right in the end. Always well, it ends well, etc. The things that we haven't mentioned is that there is tension in this park because she's meant to be meeting two people.
Yes.
One of whom is the CIA boss guy, played by Cillian Murphy.
Yep.
And the other is her KGB co-worker, who she has had a relationship with. And it's all very tense.
Yeah, well, this was the chap who recruited her in her scummy, evil, abusive boyfriend's flat to begin with, who made the promise of, oh, it's 5 years and then you're free as a bird.
So he lied to her, despite the evident sexual tension between them.
Yes.
Talking of, I was going to say sexual tension, but there's not actually that much tension. Sexual relations.
No. I was going to say, they don't leave things tense for very long, because, you know, any tension is pretty much acted on straight away.
Yeah, there's not much. For a spy film, there's not that much tension. So she also has a... Okay. She also has a girlfriend, but this relationship is very badly developed.
Yeah.
So she meets this other model in the shared house in Paris near the start of the film. And then it's implied they become girlfriends. They definitely move in together. It's implied there's like a romantic or sexual thing between them, but it's not really revisited. The girlfriend is only really there very occasionally when the film wants to show that maybe there's some more stakes.
Yeah, maybe Anna has some desire for a normal life.
Yeah.
Maybe
she seems nice.
When she's not like blowing people away.
Yeah. So anyway, that's almost like a side plot. It's not clear what's going on. I think that's about it. It's a little bit confused.
Oh, yeah. And one thing, listener, you will have picked up is in the confusion is there's lots of time jumps.
Yes, there are a lot of time jumps. And they're all signposted, which is meant to make it clearer.
Mm.
But I don't know. I feel like they want to be, Luc Besson, it wants to be a bit edgy, like, oh, let's tell a thing in a non-linear fashion that makes it more tense. But there's so little of it that's surprising that I don't think the time jumps really make any difference. You could have told it linearly and it would have been fine.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the so-called twists, there, I wouldn't say I wasn't engaged enough to be trying to figure out what was going to happen, but each thing that happened, I wasn't like,
no, exactly.
My goodness, didn't see that coming. Although I didn't explicitly see it coming, if you see what I mean. It was just like, oh, okay, that's another thing that happened. But I think you're absolutely spot on. It's a gimmick. There isn't, like, it's basically so you can reveal things. You can hide things in order to get to reveal them later. Which, yeah, it's just like time jumps can be done really well. I mean, the classic one people talk about is Pulp Fiction, which I haven't seen for years, but I seem to remember that being pretty effective. So it's not that it can't be done well. It's just it's kind of a bit pointless.
Yeah, it's a bit pointless, and it just feels like a bit of an affectation.
Yes, yeah.
What
did you think of the tone? I mean, you've kind of talked about it a little bit, and this is a pretty loaded question, I must admit.
It's because it's a bit all over the place. Like, it can't quite decide what it wants to be. It, like, it sets up, particularly, like, the wrist-slitting scene. But,
yeah,
like, it sets up these kind of, like, oh, this is grim, this is hard, like, this is a hard-hitting, like, film that's tough to watch, and you should care about these people because they have hard lives and everything is grim. But then there's also, like, just big, like, schlocky action set pieces, like, so, and a lot, so much sort of spy film, like, cliche, which is not that, which is not intrinsically bad if you want to watch. Like, there's no wrong with wanting to watch a spy film that's just sort of action-y and fine, but it doesn't really settle on what it wants to be, and the kind of grittier bits didn't find it made me care about what happened to the people in the other scenes particularly.
Yeah, it was supposed to, like, and I wondered what the whole, like, scummy boyfriend thing was doing there. The best I can come up with as an explanation is it's showing us she had this really terrible life, and that's, I guess, because it's pretty difficult for a Western audience to identify with somebody who joins the KGB. If they were just like, they were just having a normal-ish life, and then a KGB guy shows up and says, want to join the KGB? And they're like, sure. Then it's a bit like, ugh, KGB, they're horrible and evil and gross, aren't they? So why would I like this person? But when it's a, well, he didn't give you any choice and you were, like, a drug addict suffering, like, physical, mental, verbal, probably sexual abuse at the hands of this really nasty piece of work partner slash boyfriend. It's like, I probably would take the way out, although, as we've established, it seems like she would rather just end her life than choose that over staying with the boyfriend. And then you also talked about the girlfriend, because I felt like that was set up, like, semi well when she goes into the flat. And it's really crowded and hectic and busy, but you see her and the name of the girlfriend is Maud, I think we discover. But they both give each other a kind of hello kind of look, and it's very mutual, like. It's strongly that, you know, there is an attraction here.
Yeah, but she's not doing it because it's part of her cover.
No, it's just like she actually thinks that Maud is hot. But it kind of then totally walks that back, like, later on, because any time, like, Maud is
trying to, like, get her into bed or whatever, she's just like, I'm tired or I'm stressed out. I need my own space. Whereas, you know, later on in the film where she has the opportunity to get down to it with either Alex, who is her, the KGB recruiter, or Cillian Murphy, it's like, yep, getting right onto that, and there's no, like, hesitation. I mean, you could argue, well, she's mainly doing that, you know, to kind of gain power over those guys rather than being particularly into it. Actually, that is one of the dumbest things in the whole movie, is her and Alex getting down to it in a cupboard in Lubyanka, the KGB building, which is, you know, now where the
sort of leaning
FSB
up against the boiler.
Yeah, yeah. Right before she is about to off her, you know, ultimate boss. So it's just like, that's probably not the best way of, like, not drawing attention to yourself. I mean, I don't know whether the walls inside Lubyanka are just incredibly thick, so no sound can get out. But it was pretty stupid.
Can we talk for a minute about? I was going to say anachronisms. There are some definite anachronisms that we'll get to, but yes. Also. Kind of tying into that, like, inconsistencies, where in the gritty past, with her abusive boyfriend, everyone is speaking Russian in this 10 to 15 minute scene.
Yeah.
And in the rest of the film, everyone is just speaking English with various different accents.
Yeah, with various levels of commitment. So, I mean, the irony is, in terms of when she's speaking in, supposedly in Russian, but to other, you know, non-Russian actors, to non-Russian actors, because Sasha Luce is Russian, she doesn't speak with a particularly pronounced accent. I mean, I guess in real life, she's been speaking English for a long time and therefore has, you know, a barely detectable accent. Whereas Helen Mirren in particular is like, "Hello, I am Olga. I am your boss, and I am a real hard arse, and don't even try it." I mean, she's having a lot of fun, but it's... I mean, I think that just comes down to they hired a Russian-speaking actor to play scummy, evil, abusive boyfriend, and then they hired, you know, a big name like... Helen Mirren, and then Luke Evans is, you know, he's been in some Hollywood films that are reasonably big, and yeah, they got them for the names, so then you've got this inconsistency. In passing, listeners who've been with us for a little while, and if you've watched this film and also Attraction, which we covered at the end of last series, you may well recognize the abusive boyfriend, as that is the actor Alexander Petrov, who was the horrible, abusive boyfriend in that as well. So apparently he's... he seems
it's a bad bit of typecasting.
Possibly,
Unless
yeah.
He's a horrible, abusive person, which obviously I hope he isn't.
So we have no reason to believe that is the case. But certainly it seems like Luc Besson or the casting person saw Attraction and went, "He's pretty nasty. We need him in this." So then it is really weird that you have, you know, these relatively lengthy scenes in Russian that are gritty, and then, like, he dies, and then the other supposed Russians that Anna is interacting with are not played by Russians, and therefore it has to be in English. It's just like, maybe I shouldn't care, but it does take you out of it.
Yeah, it does. They don't really commit to being either we're going to get everyone to speak Russian when it's appropriate, or just have everyone speaks English.
All the time,
Just all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I thought, although they're misplaced in terms of the tone of the film overall, I thought those horrible abusive boyfriend scenes were pretty well done. I mean, Alexander Petrov is, he does a good job of being menacing and horrible.
I almost want two versions of this film. I know that Luc Besson, as a result of the failing Valerian, doesn't have a lot of money to play with these days. But I kind of wish he'd made it twice. Like, one gritty, serious take on the character, and another one that was just sort of
the throwaway.
Yeah,
throwaway around.
Exactly,
yeah.
Action spy movie. And I think that would have been interesting. And what we got is like a weird mashup that doesn't really work. That's not to say that there weren't decent performances. Like, I can't think of any performances that I just thought, like, ugh. Like, everyone is fine.
Yeah, I mean, Helen Mirren is, as I've mentioned, kind of chewing the scenery, but that's quite fun to watch.
Yeah, and it's kind of her character in this film, because she's not in any of the, like, grittier scenes.
No, but it does establish that she's supposedly pretty ruthless. I mean, going back to... Sorry, we've already covered this, but going back to the tone thing, there was a couple more things I wanted to mention in terms of, like, the nastiness. Like, with the German guy in the hotel in Milan that Anna is supposed to be assassinating, and then the CIA steps in and stops her. With that, she then has to, like, cut this guy's finger off, because that's, like, the proof that Olga wants that she's done the deed, and also they need it for, like, for the fingerprint. And quite a big deal is made of this cutting off the finger. So this guy doesn't die, but Cillian Murphy's like, well, if you need the finger, you need the finger. And then Anna is like, well, you can't do it. I have to do it because there's a special kind of cut that the KGB teach you to do when they're teaching you to cut people's fingers off, and you won't know how to do it properly, so I have to do it. And it's just like, that is quite a lot of attention to pay to quite a grisly detail.
Again, this kind of sudden, like, are we going to have like a minute or a couple of minutes of like dark grittiness because for some reason.
Yeah, and then the other thing, which is not nearly on the level of, you know, cutting somebody's finger off. Oh, and that's weird, just because Cillian Murphy's like, yeah, fine. And the guy, who I thought was a German diplomat, actually, rather than an arms dealer. I mean, I may have got that confused.
No, you may well be right. I thought the first guy was an arms dealer, but you're right, might be.
Yeah. And he was like, this isn't what I agreed to. And Cillian Murphy's like, well, it's what's happening to you, so it's better than being dead, right? He never actually says that, but that's the strong implication. So, yeah, so his finger gets taken. But anyway, the other pretty violent thing in terms of, like, it's dwelt on is she has various fashion shoots throughout, which, you know, as you might expect when her cover is being a fashion model. But it's this very nervous, geeky English photographer who really, really, really gets on her nerves and is also making her late for an appointment she really has to be at. So she completely loses it and then just, you know, jumps on this guy and starts just, like, smashing him in the face and, like, taking photos of him, like, cowering.
It's not clear whether this is meant to be funny. Like, is this meant to be a comedy, or is this meant to be, like, a brutal takedown of
horrible, pompous fashion people? Because there's like a triptych of pompous fashion photographers throughout. There's one who's French, there's one who's American, and then there's one who's English. I think the English one is the one you see last. And she just,
I think so.
At this point, she's just losing it with all this crap, and she just goes to town on his face.
Yeah, it's not Stephen Merchant, but it's the kind of guy that Stephen Merchant might play.
Yes.
That I remember feeling that kind of.
Yeah, reminded me a little bit of David Schneider, who was one of the co-writers of Death of Stalin, and he's done other stuff with Amando Iannucci. He's occasionally in things in kind of like bit parts. But yeah, he's, you know, with the best will in the world, a slightly nerdy looking gentleman. And that's, it's just like, it's very, I mean, yes, he was being annoying, but it's kind of apropos of nothing. And also, she has this cover that she's supposed to be keeping. I mean, I don't know whether we're supposed to understand that she's such a big modeling star at this point that she can kind of behave really badly and get away with it. Because, I mean, goodness knows, you hear stories of well-established, successful models behaving appallingly and, you know, whacking people.
That sort of celebrity thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I have so much money that, yeah, even if they fine me, it's going to be like 2 days' work's worth rather than, you know, a serious concern and you'll never work again type thing.
Do you think that the tonal shifts were deliberate? I mean, I know they were deliberate in the sense that someone directed and edited this film. but I don't know, like when they set out to make it, do you think that was in like their minds? Like this is going to be a thing that is all these different things mashed up? Or do you think it just kind of, I don't know.
I think it just kind of ended up that way. It just doesn't seem like particularly thought out. It just seems like, oh, we wanted all of these elements and we didn't like take 3 or 4 steps back at the thing we were potentially about to create and going, does this actually work together for, you know, as a cohesive whole?
Because then that, sorry, carry on.
That was, I think it was going to be my main point, really. It was just like, there was a 90-minute throwaway action film here, or even like slightly shorter than that, because you get, you know, more than half an hour's worth of like fairly ploddy stuff. Yeah. But yeah, it's virtually 2 hours long, you know, to the minute. And it's just like, it doesn't need to be that long.
No, it doesn't need to be that long. An hour and a half would have probably made it a better film.
Yeah.
But then there's a couple of things that, I don't know, is it laziness or deliberate trolling? Because they were definitely conscious choices, either conscious choices to be lazy or conscious choices to not care.
Just be like, in your face.
Yeah, about historical things and about anachronistic things, which was so, I'm not the kind of person that, I don't know, when watching films, I am most of the time, usually unless it's something that I know lots about, which is, let's be honest, not that much stuff.
But sell yourself short, Lynn.
No, but I mean, I'm willing to, by and large, like, suspend disbelief and not care too much about minor things. Like,
yeah,
you know, I know that there'll be notes on the internet that, I don't know, there's some film with, like, a phone that didn't come out until 1993, and the film is set in November 1992. And you're like, you know what?
Yeah.
It's 6 months different something. I don't.
I'll let it slide.
Like, yeah, it's an oversight that's understandable and that it doesn't affect the film. But I don't know. It's such deliberate trolling. Like, I've been on the IMDb page since, and I don't know. It's like the first thing the goof says to you. You're like, you can't. It's not a goof. Like, it's so intentional because all of the technology in this film, would they, maybe even cars? I don't know much about cars.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this,
but
this
even look that way. Like, everything is about a decade out. Like, all the mobile phones they use, the laptops they use, are, like, late 90s to early, like, into the 2000s.
Yeah. We see one, like, brick phone, which is in a scene we haven't talked about, retrieved by Anna from a, I guess he's a gangster or something,
like
from a Moscow cafe.
It's like her first mission, isn't it? To kill this gangster and get his phone. That was actually a pretty good action scene.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe that's why we haven't talked about it, because we haven't really got much in that scene to moan about.
Yeah, well, let's get all the things that we hated out the way.
I don't think I hated the anachronisms, because I think they were too obvious to hate.
Yeah, but
like,
it was
just
like,
okay, fine, this is another weird thing that they've decided to do here, because...
Yeah. I mean, it's not like he doesn't know. This isn't a film made by, like, a callow, like...
No, there is
21-year-old
no
filmmaker who hasn't done his research. This is, a 50-year-old man who was making films in the late 80s. He knew what technology was around then and what wasn't. And it's just, like, the film's just like, people are going to have, like, Nokias from the turn of the millennium in... like 1990.
Yep. And she's going to steal all the data on USB flash drives.
Yeah.
I think it also was not invented in 1990. But it doesn't matter. It's just there for convenience.
Yeah. And she's going to apply or consider applying for a job in the Soviet Navy on her laptop, which apparently is connected to the internet.
Again, in like 1985, yeah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter to the film. And I think it would matter less, especially in those, even more so in those gritty scenes. If, like, if it's just a kind of fun genre spy movie, those things do not matter. Like, I don't care about pedants on the internet claiming they do. It doesn't matter.
No.
But somehow, like, if you're going to try and settle on this, like, ooh, it's gritty, I don't know. There's, like, an element of, like, realism, I think, implied in that kind of grittiness that, I don't know. Again, I don't care whether they're, like, accurate to the month, but...
Yeah, but if you want people to take the film seriously, then you have to pay more attention to that stuff, whereas if it's meant to be just totally throwaway popcorn fodder... Then, who cares? It's like, it's a James Bond movie. You have, like, a car that you can control by your phone, which, I mean, actually, probably now is not that far-fetched, but in, say, like, 1997, when Tomorrow Never Dies comes out, that's kind of like...
But it's totally impossible. It doesn't matter. Like,
if that technology doesn't exist,
So yeah, another sort of tone and thing it couldn't settle on. Also, from a kind of historical standpoint, it needs the Soviets to be super Soviet somehow. So it's set, most of the film is set in 1990, a year after the Berlin Wall falls, a year before the Soviet Union falls.
Yeah.
And no one cares.
At that point, like, Soviet-aligned Warsaw Pact countries, their communist governments are, you know, are crumbling, and Gorbachev has the option, you know, of following the standard Soviet playbook of, like, well, they're not playing ball, so in go the tanks, and he doesn't do it. And also, you know, within the republics of the Soviet Union, you have people demonstrating against Moscow being overbearing, and yes, there was violence, but there wasn't, like, a concerted from the very top down, like, we are, you know, crushing this with, like, maximum force in the way that they'd done in Czechoslovakia in the 60s and Hungary in the 50s. It just, but none of that, like, the Cold War is kind of coming to a close, is there at all. In fact, like, you know, the leader of the KGB is kind of, like, ramping things up. And it's just, like, in some ways, it's like, why is this even set in the period that it's set, other than, like, we want it to be the KGB because they're, like, an unambiguous baddies for a Western audience, you know?
Yeah, maybe if they'd have set it 10 years previously, I don't know. Could have got some late 70s, early 80s fashion in well.
Well, I mean, and it would make more sense if it's, like, I don't know, like, 79, 80 to 85, because that was, like, knife edge point in the Cold War where it, you know, people who lived through it say, yeah, it did seem like somebody was gonna blow up the world, you know. And it's just like, yeah, although they don't really focus on, like, the nuclear side of things at all. It's just about, like, spies murdering each other for the most part.
Yeah, there's not much of an external threat beyond the spy agencies.
Yeah, it's all focused on Anna, and, you know, is she going to get to retire to Hawaii or wherever, or is she going to be killed by somebody? Actually, again, sort of harping on the tone, but her backstory, such as it is that her parents died, and that's totally, her parents' death is totally
played
for laughs.
Yeah, I completely forgot about that. Yeah, it's like a 20-second scene, isn't it, of them getting hit by a truck?
Yeah, because they're, like, they're essentially making out in the car and not paying attention to this, you know, hulking great truck that, you know, like,
oh yeah, but
head
it,
on.
Right, it is done in such a sort of corny way, like, this played sort of for laughs, and then back again into this grittiness.
Yeah, and also just, like, the whole, like, well, then how did her parents dying end up with her becoming a drug addict and a homeless person, to the extent that her abusive boyfriend says, you know, you'd be turning tricks for a living if it wasn't for me? And I'm kind of like, okay, well, I don't want to paint too rosy a picture of Soviet communism here, but yes, I think there were homeless people, but in general, there was a full employment policy. So essentially, you could get a job. It would be a crappy job, but you'd have a roof over your head and you'd have enough money for, you know, basic, you know, subsistence rations. And the only way you'd end up without that was if you were like a persona non grata, because they tended to use, you could be penalized for being unemployed. Basically, they'd call it parasitism, and then they could put you in prison if you were like supposedly refusing to work. And what would happen, like with dissidents, is that basically word would get around that any place that they applied for a job would turn them down. So then it would look like they weren't trying to get work, and then you could like throw them in jail. I mean, I'm sure I'm garbling that, but essentially, you know, it was relatively hard to be unemployed and, you know, absolutely like destitute in the way that she's depicted in the film. I mean, Russian listeners who know this this period better, please feel free to write in and correct me if this is not the case. But yeah, I get the impression that it was harder to end up on the streets in the Soviet Union of this period than it would be to say now, to be honest.
So all these are really points in the like, don't care kind of schlocky spy film column. But yeah, then, yeah, it just seems incongruous. Just cut out the gritty parts.
Yeah, well, and
just
a lot
have
is,
it as a fun thing.
Yeah, a lot is made of the fact that she's an orphan, because Olga says, well, actually, this is a problem. She doesn't have anyone that she cares about, therefore we don't actually have any leverage over her. And it's kind of like, yeah, her parents were killed, but are we to assume that like both of her parents were only children, and that, you know, neither of her parents had any friendships,
yeah, no relatives
or social relationships? Because I know when I was, I guess, a young teenager, it occurred to me to ask the question to my parents, like, if something ever happened to you, what would happen to us? And they were like, well, you know, we have friends who we've kind of have like a mutual agreement that if something happens,
you have to join MI6. It's the only way.
Yeah. You have to become an assassin for pay. but yeah, so it's kind of like that just was also, I'm probably giving this film more thought than, that it probably deserves, but yeah, you have alluded a little bit to stuff that was enjoyable.
Yeah, there were some good action scenes. That one where Anna does her first like hit, I guess, against this gangster guy at a restaurant is fun. Like, it's well choreographed. I don't know whether it's, what's her name, Sasha Luz.
Yes,
I don't know whether it's her doing the stunts or whatever, but it's well cut. Like, it's cut in a way that you can tell what's going on, but it's still cool looking. Yeah, like, it's a fun scene. The only criticism I would make slightly is that she is, like, super badass, except when, like, everyone else is either dead or injured or has run away. And the last gangster then, who is this, like, kind of big, pretty unfit older dude, like, comes up behind her and then...
He's very burly, though. He seems to be, like, a combination of, like, fat and muscle.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure the implication is he's strong, but then also that he is super stealthy.
Yeah,
so like, sneaks up behind her.
Yeah, gets the jump on her. Yeah, that's right.
And then it's like she is kick-ass, except on those moments where the film needs her not to be suddenly.
Temporarily, yeah.
Yeah, which is a bit weird. But the rest of the scene was fun. And
yep, some good plate murder.
Good plate murder. Is that a good band name? I don't think it is.
No.
Might be a good album name.
Like, gratuitous fork stabbing. How about that?
Gratuitous fork stabbing. Yeah. Also, she tries to murder him with a fork, or does murder him with a fork, but it seems like the least effective way, as someone who's never murdered anyone with anything. But if I was going to not use this podcast as evidence in the court of law...
It's out there. It's in the public domain.
No!
Lynn read out his death list. I said top priority is
But yeah, and like the Olga and Alex are waiting outside in the car, and it's kind of like, oh, we should get it done in time. Although it didn't feel that tense.
She comes out like with her very nice fur coat and fur hat, like dripping with
just
blood.
It's drenched in blood.
And there just happens to be no passers-by.
It's a quiet street. It didn't look like that much of a quiet street, but it was conveniently.
It's quiet-ish, but it's also, it's the middle of the day in the Russian capital, and, you know, people aren't so massively diligent that every single person is slaving away at their desk, you know, until, you know, six in the evening, so nobody's going to be out and about.
Yeah, I mean, it can't have been that quiet because there was a restaurant full of people.
Full of patrons, yeah. Well, also, the gangster guy is wearing a giant cross. It's very blingy. And I didn't note this very carefully, but it didn't look like an Orthodox cross with, like, the extra little crossbar on there. So, you know, I'm going to ding it for that. But also, just in general, like, I mean, I know it's the late 80s and there's more, like, tolerance around stuff because of perestroika. Not that they talk about in the film at all. But still, it doesn't seem like a brilliant move wearing big religious symbols out in the open. Again, any Russian listeners who happen to remember the late 80s Soviet Union, you know, if I'm totally wrong about, you know, the acceptableness of, you know, religious iconography and clothing, yeah, please do write in. But I, yeah, that just seemed very weird.
Olga has an Orthodox cross, doesn't she? I might be wrong about that, but I thought she did.
Which would be very weird, very weird for a person in the KGB. But
he's trolling us. It's all an allegory about religious persecution, the whole film. I've figured it out.
Yeah.
I'm going back to university to do film studies right now. I need more student debt. So yeah, that was a fun thing. And like the escape at the end where she's running out of the KGB building and being chased is quite fun.
And doing like scissor takedowns in a Black Widow style.
Yeah. Oh, that was very, it was very Black Widow-y. But yeah, like some of the action scenes were fun, but
yeah, and the fashion / murder montage.
The fashion murder montage was
set to In Excess at Need You Tonight.
Nice, good reference there. I did not get that.
I had to look that up because it was kind of like, I recognize this song. It's very 80s kind of like pop rock. But yeah, I think we talked about this in the intro that we haven't seen Atomic Blonde, but it kind of almost seems a bit like Luc Besson saw that and went, yeah, that's a good idea. I'll do that. And I'll have some, like, period-appropriate pop rock music on the soundtrack. Wham.
Yeah, actually, the soundtrack.
You could have had Wham on there.
Should have had Wham.
Yeah.
Should have been Club Tropicana for some reason.
Yeah. Well, it could have
It could have been anything, to be honest, given how consistent
Chameleon,
it was.
Because she did come and go between different countries and different...
She came and went, yes.
Yeah.
Ah. Yeah.
Missed opportunity.
Dear Luc Besson, I hope you're okay, I guess.
Well, yeah. I hope you didn't do the things that you are alleged to have done, because that's awful.
Just be a better person, Luc Besson.
Yeah.
I like The Fifth Element, and I quite enjoyed Valerian, even though no one went to see it. And neither did I, because I watched it on Netflix.
Yeah, and those movies are kind of bonkers, but they're consistently bonkers.
Yes.
I mean, this, in terms of like the slight tonal weirdnesses, this did slightly remind me of one of his French language films, The Adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec, which is about a like kind of a female version of Indiana Jones, but set in the 19th century French Empire. That's mostly very, very kind of like knockabout silliness. You have like a pterodactyl and like resurrected mummies that are actually, you know, fairly benevolent compared to, you know, what you can normally expect from Egyptian mummies risen from the grave. So it's got some of this stuff in it, and that's like the main overall tone. But it also has this thing about how her identical twin sister is in like a permanent comatose state due to getting a hairpin through her brain in a freak tennis accident, and it's just like, why sure. is that in there? So he does have form in terms of like having like.
Is it also too long? Could they? I don't know how long the Adventure of Adolph Longsack is. But I'm
wondering, I think
if there
was
just...
that did slightly overstay.
Same
its welcome,
kind of thing. You just needs a better editor. Sorry, whoever edited this film. It was probably Luc Besson, wasn't it? If the editor of that film was listening and you were overridden in your choices by Luc Besson, I apologise.
You should have stood up to him. Said, no, this is a mess, Luke. You need to make this a tight 90 minutes, shoot 'em up, non-complicated, non-faux gritty nonsense thing.
So what did we think about this film, Ali? Not that we have to agree.
I think it had its moments, like we've discussed. Some of the fight scenes were pretty good. The performances were pretty decent. I mean, Sasha Luce acquitted herself pretty well in, like, you know, not a well-scripted film. Oh, in passing, the poor script thing, that's just reminded me of, like, probably the two most clunky things in terms of the script. So, the arms dealer, sorry, I'm just going back to dunking on this film.
Written and directed by Luc Besson.
Yes, so he's fully responsible. So, first thing, arms dealer, you know, maybe boyfriend until she, like, puts several holes in his upper abdomen. He says to her, these are both Russian characters, says, oh, you should really visit St. Petersburg at some point because it is beautiful and it is the window on Europe. And it's kind of like, yes, this is something that all Russians would know about St. Petersburg, but would not need to therefore explain to each other that's very much for the benefit of audiences. If you don't know very much about St. Petersburg, it's the window in Europe. So that was stupid. It just seems like Luc Besson heard that once and went, that's kind of poetic sounding. I want to shoehorn that into my movie. Anyway, so that's clunker number one. And then massive clunker number two is the speech towards the end where Anna explains that she's kind of like a Russian doll and like she's a woman, but inside that woman is a spy and inside that is a model, and then you keep going down, there are all these different things that there are, and then when you get down to the lowest layer, there's this tiny little thing, and she doesn't know what that last one is, and she wants to find out what that is, and that's why she's got to carry on living. And it's just like, wow. So you decided to write a movie about a Russian female character, and the cleverest thing you could come up with is that she's somehow like a Matryoshka doll. It's just like, someone needed to have a word with him and just go, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, Luke. Stop it. Anyway, what did you think?
Yeah, no, you're right. Just stop the podcast there. I thought some of the cinematography was nice. According to IMDb, I couldn't find mention this was actually filmed in Russia. So for all the Russian scenes, I mean, they have some like long shots of Russian cities, but it's very well done, like merged in.
Pretty much all Moscow. And I did enjoy doing some like sightseeing of, you know, places that I've been. That was quite gratifying. I did enjoy that.
So yeah, it was, it's like looked nice. I think it was just, I wish I'd cared. And maybe that's, I don't know. Am I a psychopath?
No.
No, I don't want to like lack empathy, like, because there was a core there of like this person that's in bad circumstances that has a chance to get out, but that chance is like comes with a lot of cost, and maybe that cost was too high, and like maybe they can't get out, and like maybe getting out means they have to leave stuff that they've come to care about behind, and like there's all this stuff that's potentially interesting. And it just, nothing quite hooks you to really actually care about it.
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, in terms of people I cared about, I probably felt most sorry for Anna's girlfriend, Maud, because she's basically, like, strung along.
Yeah, agreed. And, like, that's not to say I just don't find the care lingered. Like, when she'd slit her wrist, you're like, oh, I don't really want this person to die, but...
And she clearly is not going to, because the movie is called Anna, and it's, you know, like, half an hour in at this point, so it's just like...
And when she's in a sort of abusive relationship and her boyfriend is being horrible, and you're like, oh, this really sucks. It's like, I hope she, you know, I hope it's not going to be all, like, this kind of horrible situation, but it doesn't linger. Like, in that individual moment, I kind of cared that this is a horrible thing that is happening to somebody.
Mm.
But that didn't make me care about what happened to her the rest of the film when it became more of a schlocky spy thing. And I think the film wanted you to care and it to set this thing up, but it just felt so disconnected that it didn't.
Oh,
really,
yeah.
Work.
It was kind of like, I mean, I don't know how you would have incorporated that element of the story later on. It would have been very clunky, but it was just like, oh, well, that's now behind you. So, hooray. Let's get back to murdering people and trying on fancy clothes.
Yep. So, in summary, I would watch it on Netflix if I was bored, maybe? That's my official rating.
Yeah, it's a don't go out of your way or spend money you wouldn't have otherwise spent on this film, I think is the most ringing endorsement. I mean, that we can give. And also in view of the, you know, it sounds like fairly credible accusations against Luc Besson, I don't feel, like, great about myself for having, like, not been aware of that and having kind of supported this movie financially. But, yeah. Oh, well.
So, do you have any better movies that you would, Russian or otherwise, recommend?
You know, in terms of, like, of a similar vein, I mean, in terms of spy things set in the late 80s, well, and in fact filmed in the late 80s, I really like the first of the two Timothy Dalton James Bond films, Living Daylights. I mean, there's some corny stuff in there, as you might imagine for a James Bond film, but it's pretty consistent throughout. I mean, I like Timothy Dalton a lot. There's
I liked him in Doctor Who.
Right.
I'm trying to think
yeah.
of anything else that I've seen him in.
I think he's in Doom Patrol at the moment, which I haven't seen, but that's getting good reviews, I think. Also, I recently rewatched Hot Fuzz, and he's the kind of grinningly sinister supermarket owner, and that was the first thing I'd seen him in for years, and it was really nice to see him. He's an actor I enjoy.
That is a film that does comedy and, I'm not going to say grittiness, it's not gritty, but like graphic, occasional graphic violence. Like, it does it much better than this film.
Yeah, well, it's not played for grit, it's played for like just how like outlandish it is. It's like the film knows what it's doing and knows what it's going for, like, every step of the way. And to be honest, when I saw it at the cinema, I enjoyed it enough, but I didn't think, like, oh, this is a masterpiece. But, like, just rewatching it and having, like, read some stuff about Edgar Wright and his craft and people pointing stuff out, I was kind of like, yeah, this is fantastically put together to the point that it all works so nicely that you, unless you stop to notice it, you kind of don't. But yeah, it just has all these kind of like visual jokes that all land and great performances. It's kind of funny seeing Olivia Colman in, you know, a bit part, and now she's...
Yeah, every time I see Olivia Colman in like an older thing, what were we watching the other day? Because she's in Peep Show and
the Mitchell and Webb.
Yeah, and every time I see her now, I'm like, Oscar winner, Olivia Colman is in all this stuff, but she's brilliant in all of it, so, you know, it's fine, but...
Yeah, I would definitely rewatch that over watching this again. Yeah, I would like to know, again, Russian listeners, what can you recommend in terms of, like, Russian spy kind of stuff? I mean, I've heard very good things about... 17 Moments of Spring, which was like a TV movie series. I think it was a 12-parter from like the early 70s.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, it's about this Soviet agent who is undercover in Nazi Germany and kind of like trying to undermine the Third Reich from within, and apparently it's meant to be incredibly tense, so I'd like to check that out at some point. And then there's another one, again 70s, although I think this is the late 70s, called The Meeting Place Cannot Be Changed, which I think is about like a Soviet detective going undercover to break up some like organized crime syndicate or something like that, and that's meant to be very good and has the, well, he's more famous these days as, well, I say these days, he died in 1980, but he's remembered as a musician / singer-songwriter. His name was Vladimir Vysotsky, but his day job was as a professional actor, and he just, my understanding is he did his singer-songwriting and recording stuff kind of on the side and was only kind of like semi-tolerated. Like, he wasn't doing official music gigs throughout the 70s. He was just able to, you know, make things work, and, you know, he recorded all these songs, and he has the most gravelly voice you've ever heard. He kind of, I mean, the closest thing in terms of English language voices would be Johnny Cash, but it's kind of like a level gravelier. I'll have to send you some like YouTube clips or whatever, and like massively not well-tuned acoustic guitars. It's like, you know, if you thought Bob Dylan was blasé about making sure his guitar was fully in tune, like this guy is even more nonchalant about that. So yeah, I'm really interested to see him in an acting role. I don't know how big his part is in that, but yeah, he was well regarded as an actor, but like mostly not remembered as primarily as that. So yeah, we'll have to check those out. All right, well, I think we should probably draw this thing to a close. Thank you very much, Lynn, for being my guest again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me along.
Yeah, it's been great to have you, and thanks for putting up with this slightly mediocre movie.
You're welcome. I'm happy to come and see mediocre movies whenever.
Awesome. All right, well, thanks for listening, and das vidanya, folks.
Das vidanya.
So that's it for another episode. If you'd like to get in touch and let me know what you thought of the film and or the episode, then there's a couple of different ways you can do that. There is Twitter, where RusFilesU. There's also a Facebook page and associated group. And there's email, of course, which is RusFilesUnite@gmail.com. If you can spare a few minutes to review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or on Podchaser, then that would be very much appreciated, as that will help more people to find out about the show, of course. So, I actually got this review a little while ago, so sorry it's taken so long to get around to, but here it is. So, this is from G3G3G3G3. And the review is titled Payekhali, so here goes. This show is truly a gem. It consistently hits that difficult balance between warmth and intellectual engagement. Before the film discussion, Ali briefly interviews the guest, and this usually goes in interesting, unexpected directions, like a review of a more recent film, or a discussion of expat life in St. Petersburg. I really appreciate the extensive Soviet coverage, and I hope this show has a very long life indeed. Keep it up. Thank you very much, G3G3G3G3, for that glowing review. Very, very much appreciated. And again, sorry it took me a little while to get around to. Okay, so besides leaving a review, you can also support the podcast financially, either by listening on the Radio Public app, as this show is part of their paid listens program, or you can donate directly on the show's Ko-fi page, which is ko-fi.com/RusFilesUnite. So that's it from me for now, and I'll speak to you next time. Bye bye.